Welcome to Cross-Cultural Poetics. Poets and writers from all over the world talk about their art and their language. I'm Leonard Schwartz. Today's guest on the phone from Brooklyn, New York, is Jihan Khan. He's a filmmaker and fiction writer. His new book just out, Halal Pork and Other Stories. It's published by Upset Press, also based in Brooklyn. I wonder, Jihan, if you could read the Crimean Saladin for us.
Okay. This is the Crimean Saladin, and it is in Halal Pork and Other Stories. Mehmet Vatanoğlu, pronounced Vatanoğlu, his real name was Mustafa Patrov. His tie was a blend of polyester and rayon, the poor man's silk. Polyrayon, although being a popular substitute for silk, actually feels nothing like the real thing. Mustafa, or rather Mehmet, adjusted the new tie, proud of his reflection. His mother had told him back in the homeland, a man's tie reflects his soul. To that effect, Mustafa, or rather Mehmet, reflected a Tatar displaced from a homeland, now living in Brooklyn, and wearing a silk tie ripoff. He brushed the dust from his overstarched shirt and threw on the corduroy blazer he usurped from the local thrift store. We say usurped here to differentiate between the slight act Mustafa committed the day before in order to get the suit and the part of the world Mustafa is actually from, which we shall refer to as quote-unquote stolen, since it was stolen from the Tatars, incidentally and more specifically, the Crimean Tatars, by the Russians way back in 1944. Crimea, or Kurim, or Q-I-R-I-M, depending on which side you're from, is little-known isthmus in the Black Sea. It is also, ironically, the point of origin for the remaining Crimean Tatars on the planet, spread out like a frugal smear of tartar sauce over a globalized fried fish fillet. Mehmet thought of his people and their cause. He thought of the search for a stolen homeland and their right to return. Mehmet thought about all these things that come with being displaced and left his house as Mustafa, savior of the Tatari. This new identity served to keep him focused and on track towards the eventual goal of all goals, the great meaning to life and solution for any poet living in a capitalist world, to buy back his stolen homeland 1 acre at a time. The idea was actually given to him by Eric Estrada, star of the hit 70s cop show Chips. Estrada appeared on a late-night infomercial asking for investments in pre-construction opportunities in Mississippi swampland. Invest now and see a huge return on your investment once the tourists start coming to the future. Mississippi Tech Burb, an ideal world of suburbs and Midwest charm meets Silicon Alley in Soho. Great idea, Mehmet thought. If a C-list actor can sell swampland based on its Midwest charm, I can sell Kurim for the same. Finally, a tangible idea could be applied to Crimea, or rather the dream of it. The dream was of the golden Khanate, complete with sultans and grand viziers and mosques inlaid with grapevines surrounded by happy people, all of them Crimean Tatar, of course, and none of them Russian, seeing as how the Russians seized the land officially 15 minutes after giving Tatar families a knock at the door at 4 in the morning. It was another case of wake up and get the fuck out and die on these train cars waiting for you. Near the end of World War II, the Tatar inhabitants were put on boundless freight trains where most died of starvation and inhumane circumstances, particularly being in train cars for over 40 days without food, water, or sanitation. Others were put on boats that were placed in the middle of the sea and sunk. Pregnant women delivered stillborn fetuses due to lack of much of anything on the train cars. Groups of young Tatar boys were massacred for made-up accusations of working with the Germans. The Crimean genocide was the last move of a 200-year push to take Crimea, which had started with Catherine the Great, who referred to the isthmus as the only place on earth that resembles heaven. So as far as genocides go, the Crimean one was essentially successful, which is why most people are unaware of it. Go figure. Tatars can only track back one generation now, like androids implanted with thought memories. Thus, you have displaced Tatars, now citizens of whatever country they landed in, escaped to, or otherwise ended up in, thinking they have no past or some seriously imagined one. More recently, the Crimea has been home to Russian vacationers and young, rich Europeans looking for a weekend to create their own memories, without the Tatars, of course. Mehmet, literally the last of the Mohicans, or in this case, the last of the Tauri, upon realizing that his homeland was being devoured by Russo hipsters in search of naked dance parties, changed his name and usurped the new suit. Eric Estrada had given him the meaning to life. The first suit was brown corduroy, because to him, the jagged smoothness of the fabric's striated pattern spoke of dynamism and style. If Calvin Klein had a say in it, he would call it Tatar chic, the new Scythian fashion confab. Little did he know the actual effects of corduroy on social interactions in the 21st century. Perhaps his first misstep, he decided his new suit should be distinctive to make him appear important to his community of Crimean Tatars in Brooklyn. This distinction would give him a platform for his new real estate revolutionaries, ASAP. A cluster of bodies in paperboy hats, corduroy denim, and polyester stood on the corner of King's Highway. They were recent to not so recent immigrants waiting in front of a door on an old brick building, above which was the misspelled sign, Assimilation Service, Reports, Green Curd, Divorce, Employment. The director of AS was a certain somebody with enough smarts to know that volume is the key to profit. Mehmet stood indifferently, last in line of immigrants, ready to spend their last borrowed dollars to become a quick American. Mehmet noticed a man climbing up the fire escape, assumingly locked out of his apartment.
Yalancı,
the man yelled, a Turkish expression tantamount to liar of lies, or the worst kind of liar. Turkish, it can be argued, is the common derivative language of most Central Asians, who oddly enough blame the Uzbeks for this. We'll perform translations for the listener from here on in, assuming an English-Turkic short story would have a limited reader base and probably be accused of insulting the other half of the hyphen.
Altan Bey,
Mehmet said.
You're a liar, Mehmet.
Hold on, I'm coming down, said the Kazakh on the fire escape. Looking at his watch, Mehmet grimaced, then returned to a more plastic smile. The Kazakh dropped down and approached him.
$60,000?
Yes, what about it?
You took my grandmother for $60,000, you dirty son of a whore?
Calm down, Altan. This is going to a good cause. I heard all about your little fantasy. You're a liar, a hustler, and... Brother, look at me. Don't you see this jacket? What about it? Said the Kazakh. I'm serious. This is not a joke. We're going to build a huge multiplex, hotel, mall, movie theater. The Kazakh stared at the corduroy brown illumination. Nice blazer. Right. I'm not joking. The Russians will be eating out of our hands in no time. Mehmet spent the greater part of the first month visiting local Crimean Tatars and pitching the idea after receiving what he called the inspiration. They were skeptical at first, but $1,000 investment turned into $10,000 and so on. Each time he pitched the idea, it got more convincing and concise until eventually he had his pitch down pat. Mehmet had mastered the American art of the sale in his own way. A newly shaved Mustafa, or rather Mehmet, sat across from the Beyanoğlu's, an older Tatar couple whose kids had been married off and whose memories of homeland permeated their modest queen's apartment. A portrait of a random scene from ancient Tartary hung prominently above the sofa they sat on. Altan Beyanoğlu, a man of staunch character and thick eyebrows, leaned towards the salesman. Mehmet Bey, your plan sounds like a fantasy. We live modest lives here, and the Russians will not let Kudum go. We have seen this over and over again since 1944. Altan's wife interceded. Yes, you could buy all the land in the world. Still, the mafia will take it up from under you, and we Tatars will just sit there, taking whatever the Russians give us or take away. Dear, let's not get into a political discussion. We cannot fight for Kudum. We are not Palestinians. Altan reached for his cigarettes, readying himself for the millionth political debate with hey, Tatars are a proud people. Do they expect a fight to come out from us? We have no will to fight them. Without hesitation, Mehmet recognized the couple's abysmal outlook and brightened up, as if feeding off the void. In the 21st century, we don't fight for land, we buy it. And if the Palestinians had any sense, they would get the richest ones to build attractions, spectacles, that if destroyed, Mehmet Bey, I understand, if you were Palestinian, I would debate you on this, but their problems are not equal to the Tatars. We were successfully wiped off the map. We have no voice, no homeland. Altan abi, Mehmet spoke sincerely, referring to the older man in the formal abi, a Turkish extension to indicate elder brother. Why do you think you do not exist? You are here. I am here. I am doing something and trying. How could you say you don't exist? The old man looks deeply into his wife's eyes, eyes that had seen the train cars, execution squads, and drownings, eyes that had witnessed her own stillborn 2 weeks after being forced into the aimless routes around southern Russia, subsequently having to dispose of the dead fetus herself, tossing it off the train somewhere in Uzbekistan. More importantly, her eyes remembered what Kerim was before the Russians, before the Germans, before the accusations and famines when exotic grapes grew in Bachasaray, decorated with history of Khans and the architecture of the Golden Khanate. Say we give you $1,000 you ask for. What is the guarantee of a return? Don't look for a financial return, Altan abi, Mehmet said with a childlike splendor. Look for a permanent return to your vatan. Vatan is an important concept for a Tatar as it only translates to homeland, but more specifically, the homeland. So vatan is always Kerim, not Queens, not Sydney, not anywhere the remaining 0.5% of the diaspora have settled. Mehmet got the investment capital remarkably, and each time his pitch refined itself more and more. The diaspora would insist it was a useless cause and enter a fatalistic mode. And as soon as their eyes glazed over with loss, Mustafa would turn into Mehmet, the sales hawk, and strike at any pessimism rising to the occasion by offering the dream. Pessimism is, after all, the playground for failure. Recep Adnan, owner of Çiburek Delight, was a lonely Tatar, his darling wife having passed away of natural causes. All he had was his store, the local Central Asian bread and olive store. Recep had no next of kin, no living family, and nowhere to place the money he had made. That is, until Mehmet came to the store and pitched his pre-construction opportunities to the Crimea. I can tell you right now the cost of land since the Soviet collapsed is increasing 10% every year. He pounded the table between the shop owner and him. Recep flinched at the motion. Recep Bey, this means if you bought a parcel of Crimea in 1994 for $10,000, it would now be worth $1 million. Recep leaned back with thick white mustache in hand, doing the calculations. Your math is all wrong, my friend. Okay, well, perhaps it is, Mehmet conceded, fixing his new burgundy corduroy blazer, purchased courtesy of his donations. The immediacy of his concession seemed odd to Recep, who replied, plus, the only way to get back home is to fight our way. Mehmet looked at Recep, felt the tiger spirit of the salesman rising, and sealed the deal. Freedom and vatan, Mehmet recited in a near-heroic final call, is bought, not fought. Recep wasn't biting. He was suspicious. Your catchphrases are indeed catchy, Mehmet. If freedom is bought, then why? Mehmet ignored the doubt just thrown at him and looked at his reflection on the handle of a spoon inside a bucket of pickled vegetables. The spoon distorted his body, making him look like a reflection in a funhouse mirror. Like a tape loop, he interrupted. Feel good about resting in peace in your homeland, where you have always belonged. Die loved. Die loved? By whom? My wife is dead. I have no family. Tell me again, brother. Who will love me when I die, if I die in Kerim? Mehmet was stunned. Up until this moment, most of his leads took him for face value. I am Mehmet Vatanoğlu. 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 Recep repeated, as if separating the syllables would reveal some hidden truth. Who is your father, Mehmet? I don't think my personal life concerns the issue of our return to Kerim, sir. Forgive me in advance, but you come into my place of business with huge claims of me being loved during death. Are you not concerned about being seen as morbid? Mehmet, or rather Mustafa, found himself in an awkward position. Among the New York Tatar diaspora, he was able to create this believable character to fund his plan, except for the shop owner. He didn't need Recep's money. Enough money was saved to actually get the plan off the ground, at least in theory. However, the fabricated Mehmet had gotten the better of the real Mustafa, and we can guess that the almighty spirit of greed was playing a role now. His catchphrases began to show a tinge of the same fatalism he was exploiting. Recep continued, your points are actually so morbid that they can be interpreted as being near threatening. Sorry for wasting your time, Mehmet, speechless and unable to crawl out of this, headed for the exit. Recep stopped him. The Vatanoğulları are known for their birthmarks on their faces. Mehmet, or rather Mustafa, stopped dead in his tracks, caught. You should have done your research before you decided to act like the Crimean Saladin. Recep leaned into a barrel of dried chickpeas, a Turkish treat known as leblebi, and dropped a handful in his mouth, waiting for the salesman to respond. Mehmet pulled the door open, his reflection distorted in the glass. He paused. The shop owner jerked his chin, very Mediterranean gesture, and shouted, "Who are you?" He was Mustafa Patrov at one point, another anonymous immigrant in the muck, a short and stout young man, probably in his late 30s. He was a man who decided to identify himself in the plural and do his part in the evolution of a new myth. "I am the bastard son of Ataturk, the shunned cousin of Genghis. I am the side of you that has rotted in memories." Mehmet turned towards the lonely shop owner, "only to be resurrected in my arteries. And if that will be all, I would like to get on with my business of making us the proud people we once were, sir." Mehmet never left the store. Recep, after hearing the salesman eulogy, gave up nearly 30% of his savings to the cause, that of the great Crimean return and the possibility of owning a homeland once and for all. His homebrewed contracts were simple and to the point. "I, blank, insert name here, under the authority of Mehmet Vatanola, hereon known as Captain Kudum Associates, give blank set amount of money for pre-construction opportunities on the Crimean Peninsula, now inhabited by lawless Muscovite bullies. I, blank, insert name here, understand that these opportunities may consist of a hotel, a condominium complex, or a New York-style pizzeria. Under the terms of this contract, it shall be known that blank, insert percentage, of all land purchased will belong to, insert name here, after the investment has returned its loss and bloomed a new Vatan. Signed, insert name here, witness, blank, Captain Kudum Associates." Vatanoğlu's assessment of the situation in Crimea had all the ingredients of purpose with a dash of highly enriched food coloring. His persistent efforts led to the fattening of both his bank account and his wardrobe, which in itself is a measure of a man's success to many mothers and parenting magazines. Not only did he have more than one corduroy blazer, he acquired a vast collection of red velvet paintings of dogs playing poker and a Segway personal transporter decorated with glyphs of Genghis Khan and Timurlane. All this in a year of fabricating the plan to resell Crimea to its original displaced, voiceless inhabitants. Amazing! The power of selling dreams led to material gain. It made sense. Sell a dream to sleepers and use the profit for your own dream while they sleep. Or so Mustafa, or rather Mehmet, thought. These are sensitive times, and even more sensitive are the minds and the skulls of the sellers of the dreams. The time it took to get investors and inject his catchphrases of purchasing freedom and being buried in the land of your ancestors monopolized much of Mehmet's critical thinking. He even may have glossed over the hard realities many families had endured and could possibly be accused of not considering all the aspects of his plan. For instance, the fact that he had never actually been to Crimea. "Come to the boat," called the captain. Mehmet, or rather Mustafa, thought, "I'm going to drown. Who is the captain?" "I am the captain, the leader of my people." "Steady now, all aboard," said the captain, undocking the small ferry. Mehmet, or rather Mustafa, had arrived in Istanbul the day before and took an exhaustive bus ride to the departure port for Crimea in northern Turkey, carrying only a very large suitcase. The bus was crowded and he crouched in a corner, being crushed by an array of diverse travelers from Germany, Russia, and Alpha Centauri in their nationally mandated Star Trek-like silver-red suits. See, the old Ukraine was now run by totalitarian sci-fi fan Pablo Escobaritov. Mehmet wore the corduroy blazer he usurped 1 year earlier and did everything he could to hide his new encrusted mouth of gold teeth. He hardly smiled, except at the woman with her farm of sad-looking chickens labeled Yeme Bukuşlar Çok Hasta, which translates from Turkish, "Do not eat, these birds are very sick." Tatars historically have been generalized as barbarians, even borderline cannibals bent on invading Muscovitian land. See Conan the Barbarian in Cimmeria, text burned by crusading Homo Gigantus in 4000 BC, or any modern Russian textbook on the subject. As for himself, Mehmet, or rather Mustafa, had a romanticized idea of Tatar history, filled with royal sultans overseeing vast empires of mosques, silks, and the songs of mystical muezzins. The reality was more likely a reconciliation of a Central Asian warrior and a Persian poet having small talk over feta cheese and vodka. "One second," yelled Mehmet, or rather Mustafa, who opened his suitcase and began to undress. The captain yelled back, "Now listen, boy, the waters are getting tougher by the second. We have to head out or we'll be staying here all night." The passengers yelled at the captain not to wait any longer. And out of the suitcase came an outfit in six parts. The sultan's turban, the elaborate Janissary clothing, the seal of the Khanate, pointy gypsy shoes, and a stick-on mustache, all of which Mustafa threw on himself before leaping onto the boat to the embarking ship. "Onward to Vatan," he yelled, pointing at the cloudy and rough waters of a particularly bad day in the Black Sea. The boat shook. Salty waters crashed against the sides. "Can you believe this water?" said a woman dressed in a silver-red Star Trek suit, obviously a post-Ukrainian, Alpha Centaurian. Mustafa avoided looking at anyone and stood motionless, like the icon he thought he was, and pointed out towards the ocean. The ship rocked, and in so doing forced Mehmet, or rather Mustafa, to lose his balance. He crouched down, attempting to recover, spreading his hands and waving around, his fake mustache dangling from his lips, his gold teeth exposed by a cringing face. The passengers were unmoved, having all strapped in prior to departure. And at last, Mehmet got his footing and rose again, looking around, feeling for his turban, his teeth, and his mustache. "What's wrong with you people?" he yelled, gripping the boat's side. "I am here to save you. Control the ship." The ship rocked again, and with such force that Mehmet, or rather Mustafa, lost his balance for the final time. And much to the dismay of many, an investor, the savior of the Tartari, the Crimean Saladin, went under, horribly, suffocating in the abysmal waters on the outskirts of a lost paradise.
Jihan, thank you so much for reading that piece. It's both very, very funny and very, very sad simultaneously, and you know, relates a narrative or a story or a history that very little is known about in this country, at least in terms of the Tatar genocide and the displacement from Russia in circa the 1940s. And so in all of those ways, it's really an extraordinary story. You have been listening to Jihan Khan read his story, The Crimean Saladin. It's from his collection of stories, Halal Pork and Other Stories. It's published by Upset Press, based in Brooklyn.
So hopefully, you know, it can teach and also put a smile on people's faces at the same time. I hope.
I hope so. I think so. It certainly did for this reader, for myself. And I've enjoyed all of the stories in it. The Crimean Saladin. You have Mizli Mehtib, the punk rock hijabi from another dimension. Tom Small, the micro crusader. Issa, the American Turk. And of course, most controversially, Halal Pork, the final and title story in the book. So I think it's a terrific book. I hope readers will look for it. And Jihan Khan, thank you so much for coming to the phone and reading for us today.
Thank you, Leonard. And I'll speak to you again in the future, hopefully.
Absolutely. We'll be right back with more of Cross-Cultural Poetics after this.